Welcome to another Poetica podcast from RN. I'm Justine Sloan-Lees with a feature on the poetry and prose of Australian writer Josephine Rowe. Josephine Rowe says one of her favourite things is long drives with no particular destination. So it's no surprise that her work inhabits in between places, both in terms of form and content. She was born in 1984. And has published two collections of short stories and two of poetry. Her writings appeared in Best Australian Poems and Best Australian Stories and the Harvard Review. Along the way, she's worked variously as a bookseller, artist model, creative writing teacher and usherette, and in 2011 was the Australian representative at the University of Iowa's International Writing Program. A while back, Josephine relocated from her native Melbourne to her husband's hometown of Montreal, where she's hoping the long cold winter will be conducive to staying indoors to write. In this program, Josephine discusses and reads her work.
Punching Wet Cement. When you were 15, you broke your hand punching wet cement. Isn't that what we're all doing? All just busting ourselves up to be remembered.
All I've ceased and I've begun to seethe in no one. Survives the line, whole line. Shines to fire beyond her eyes. It shines for no one. And we cannot see a light's light.
House. When I write of a house now, it is only ever the one house. Its smell of smoke and old wood, foxed books, dried blue gum torn lazily from the overgrown yard. Perhaps you haven't realized this yet, because in one story, I've sat you at the monstrous kitchen table, its surface a forest of knives, their tips driven into the southern mahogany. The empty knife block hidden amongst them like the woodcutter's empty cottage. And in another story, we are crouched behind the ruined shed, amongst the blood and the feathers. And from here, the kitchen cannot be seen. Stand in the birdless aviary, and you know where we are now, don't you? And you won't see me lying on the slate floor. Won't feel my hands either side of your face. You won't hear me saying, there isn't a single thing I feel sorry about. It's only ever the one house, but it's shifting, unmappable, and I can never get far enough away to see the whole of it.
So Josephine, when did you start writing? Were you one of those kids who was always scribbling away in corners at gatherings and functions and family dues?
I don't know about the gatherings and functions and family dues, but I was certainly interested in writing when I was very little. And I think my father dug up, one of your prep readers or something like that a few years ago and pointed out where I had listed the things that I wanted to be when I grew up. And there was veterinarian and florist and author. I think author was number three. I realised that maybe the other two weren't so well suited.
I mean, floristry would be very nice, of course. But when do you think you turned your focus on writing?
Away from floristry? I'm not exactly sure of the precise moment, to be honest. I mean, my mother used to read Banjo Paterson poems to myself and my sister at night time. That was those were our bedtime stories, and those and really sad children's poems in which the child dies in the
kind
course of the night.
Victorian Gothic ones,
sort of from the old, you know, the old Victorian readers that they would have. The one about the boy who dies in the middle of the night, and his toy dog and soldier wait on the stairs forever, and the original version of the Little Mermaid and things like that. Those are the sort of stories that she favoured, I suppose. Not so much with the happy endings, my mother. I think I came to poetry and to writing in general because I am a much better communicator on the page. I'm a fairly erratic thinker. I'm a tangential conversationalist. It's better for me if I kind of put all of those scraps and noise down on the page, and then I can sort through them and make sense of things and make things a little bit more clear and communicable, most importantly. That's really the crux of what you're doing in any art form, I think.
You describe yourself as working at the intersection of poetry and prose. Now, those two labels, I can understand they're important to library catalogers, mm-hmm. one of whom I'm married to, and perhaps to the marketing department of publishing houses. But for the rest of us, does it matter?
I'd like to think it doesn't, but It's a question that I'm asked again and again. Is this a short story or is it a poem? As though I might be, you know, kind of sneakily smuggling fiction into poetry or the other way around. And you get kind of people from both camps trying to recruit you. You know, you can tell me it's a poem, really, isn't it? It's a poem. No, it's a story. Come on, you can say. And I'm not really interested in the precise delineation of those two different genres. I'm happy to kind of work in the strange no man's land in between.
Casablanca, 2 a.m. The rain hasn't stopped. Your flight hasn't landed. Soon I'll get up, watch Casablanca. And by the time Bogart has never actually said, "Play it again, Sam," you will have climbed the 17 concrete stairs to my apartment. And there is nothing remarkable about a man carrying a small red suitcase up a flight of stairs. Nothing extraordinary about a woman watching black and white movies to keep herself awake. Or about aeroplanes, or taxis, or the unopened bottle of Lafroy on the dresser. Nothing about the smell of the rain or the flicker of the screen that suggest any more than any of this. Just the room forgetting how to breathe with us inside it. This is The Man Who Shot Lions, and it's an example of a poem that started life as a story that was a couple of thousand words long, and it ended up being cut down and pared back and pared back and pared back until it became a 14-line poem, because I realised I could cram everything that I needed, all the ideas from the story that I needed to be there into these few lines. The man who shot lions. We didn't know that about him then, when we started reading his books. But once we found out, they were always there. In the trenches of his war stories, in the grandstands at his racetracks and boxing matches, present at his bullfights or padding softly through the dirty Parisian streets, there were always the lions. Solemn, slow-moving beasts, whose large paws made no noise, and whose whiskey-coloured eyes missed nothing.
Thank you.
story. By 3 a.m., all the life had been thrashed out of it. Parents carried melancholic children back to the car park to fall asleep on back seats under piles of salty coats. Lovers wrapped in blankets sat listening for whale breath and heard nothing, shook the sand out of their clothes, and went home to make a sad sort of love. This is the whale that later appeared in all your friends' photographs and short stories. The topography of ventral grooves in moonlight. Anthropomorphisms of heavy machinery used to drag the dead whale from the surf. If I were asked to write about the whale, I would still end up writing about you. How you were somewhere in Canada or South America that morning, turning to a loose page in your notebook and writing, "Not entirely trusting this page to remain attached, I shall write nothing of consequence on it." And I didn't know you then. I didn't know how I would stay awake all night in the house your great-grandfather built, writing poems with the pencils you used as a child.
In your writing, to me, there's a number of things that keep cropping up again and again and again. So I'm just going to throw some of them at you.
Sure.
Movement to and from, movement sometimes with purpose, but movement other times just for the sake of moving.
So transience is a big thing, especially in Tarkata. Tarkata Wake is just full of hotels and long roads and all of these in-between sorts of spaces where people are trying to kind of walking steadily away from or towards some kind of personal disaster. I guess that's the thing. All stories kind of need to take place at that moment of transition. Otherwise, there's not really a story. I guess people argue about what are the crucial things you need for a short story to work. And I think that for me, the only real necessary element is distance. So the distance between what somebody wants and what they have, or where they are and where they want to be, or where they are and where they've been. And that distance doesn't even necessarily need to be covered within the story. It just needs to be present.
Something else that comes up is cartography, topography,
map
and
making,
landscapes.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you love maps?
I do love maps. Well, I'm not a great reader of maps. As in, I'm not very good with directions. I'm not the best navigator to have in your passenger seat. Not that you need navigators in your passenger seat nowadays. The Melways is becoming a bit of a relic. But the idea of maps, I suppose, is something that I'm certainly interested in. And poetry for me is certainly a way of orienting myself in new spaces and amongst new people. It's something that I guess I distinguish from short stories for that reason. There is an instinctual kind of drive behind poetry, and often it is that need to kind of to make sense, to map out, to orientate.
And your more recent work, home is an issue.
Yeah.
The idea of home.
Well, I guess it's the natural progression from that transience of the stories in Tarkata Wake that I'm now really thinking about what is home, where is home. The longer stories in that collection are very much more concerned with place. And I wrote them towards the end of putting the manuscript together, actually in my little hotel room in Iowa City, thinking a lot about Australia. And I think having that geographical distance from Australia enabled some sort of clarity or crystallization in terms of thinking about the Australian landscape and the stories that go alongside with that. And I guess if it doesn't sound pat, maybe the best analogy is if you've got a tree that has a kind of deep, healthy root system, then the canopy is going to be reflective of that. And that probably has something to do with those stories being longer as well than these other stories that are in almost placeless interiors. It's a hotel room or an airport. It could be anywhere in the world. And then these very grounded stories that that end up becoming much longer and much more layered.
And yet you're about to relocate and start off a whole new life on the other side of the world in Canada.
That's probably why these questions are kind of coming to the fore. I suppose home for me as well is not something that I feel I've experienced in a really traditional sense. I didn't grow up feeling that the house we lived in was home. My family situation was quite volatile. I grew up feeling like home was ahead of me somewhere and I would go out and I would earn it or make it or something like that. And to some extent, I feel like I'm getting closer to it. But I still feel like it's ahead of me somewhere. I was chatting with a friend about this the other day, and he brought up the Frost poem, Death of a Hired Man, which has this great line about home, that it's something you somehow haven't to deserve. And I loved thinking about that, and that idea of home as being different to inherited or earned, which is, I suppose, the two ways we tend to think about home. It's something that you are, it's a birthright. Or it's something that you build for yourself, and then there's this third other way, which doesn't incorporate either of those. What I know of doorways. 1. Here, I am 5 years old, or 8 years old, or 10. Between my father, wild, throwing punches and hard words and spit, and my mother, saying nothing now, the door handle pressed into the small of her back. My mother's body is soft and warm as sleep, as my father beats a hole beside her head. Years later, my mother slips through this hole. The door is replaced so that I cannot follow. 2. Watching sheet lightning through a screen door in Bairnsdale. I sit in the hallway and lean forward when the sky turns silver. In the next room are relatives I do not know. Their children stand back from the windows, eat slowly, are adequate. They don't pretend to like me. 3. My sister and I get up at dawn. The back door creaks, so we open it slowly, by inches. Everything is grey, our faces and breath. The house and hills. We climb onto the roof, staining the palms of our hands and the soles of our feet, red with dust from the tiles. We are waiting. I can't remember what for. 3. Birthday poem. She called it out of the dark with a soft the black mare who would let no one else touch it. We leaned against the parked car and saw nothing. Then
the white diamond forehead appearing from blackness, cloak of a horse folded gently around. She bent her head to kiss my sister's fingers, which look like yours, like mine. Before they both turned and ran, the wire fence between them, their hair whipping back as they passed us like an exquisite regatta, illuminated by headlights and moon. If there were one thing I could carry back to you, it would be this. Like a parcel hidden under my coat, to be unwrapped on your chest after visiting hours. The hospital room flooding with February night, machines deafened by the heartbeat of your unborn granddaughter, by hooves drumming the soft earth. And you would know. You would know, you would know of the beautiful marks you have left on the world. So this is Vanellinae, and I guess it's an example of a failed poem. It's a poem about a poem that I wanted to write about visiting my my father in a repatriation clinic. And there was some camaraderie amongst the men there. And every morning they would get up and they would stand by this window and smoke together, and God knows what they talked about, but there was a nest of plover eggs out in a field outside the window, and every morning they would get together and watch the plovers coming back to these eggs, and eventually the eggs hatched, and so every morning they'd be watching the chicks through their stages of development, and they're quite fluffy when they're little, I think, plover chicks. So they're kind of watching these baby birds, wondering when they're going to become big enough and strong enough to fly. And at around this point, the gardener goes on leave and his replacement is unaware of the plover nest. And he drives the ride-on mower right over it and kills all the birds. So this is kind of about that. Vanellinae. And I know now about the birds, their Latin name, their population and international distribution. I know their migratory patterns, have watched footage of them in flight, could write about the slow, irregular beat of wing or shrillness of call. But still do not know how to write about you. Standing at the window that morning at the repatriation clinic, grey in the early light alongside the other old soldiers, and all of you just watching the birds in the grass outside. Seven of you there at the window, not speaking, only smoking, as you'd smoked through decades of daily crossword, instant coffee, broken families, anger management, repeat prescriptions, therapy through wood and leather work, and all those things nobody talks about. You stood smoking and watched the birds build a nest. And though I know the word Vanellinae, I still do not know how to write about what you and those grey men were waiting for.
If I could show, funny how everything makes you feel bleed, what you already love. But it comes out on the back, so tribal banging down. Leave now, get up, fall asleep from the window. I worry to see the rain still coming down. Get these downstairs, it's hot coffee. Sit down to cigarette, two down to the top line. Another in downtown lines, keep another in my last penny. Well oiled. Forget again. 4 a.m. 6 feet down. Already up with the locks. And I go stumbling through. You let me forget again. 4 a.m. 6 feet down. Already up with the locks. Forget what I always knew.
are the writers that have had most impact on you?
Maybe it's best to look at the writers who have stayed with me as being seminal and influential and validating over the past nearly a decade that I've been writing in any kind of professional sense. Jane Ann Phillips, her collection Black Tickets, is something that I read when I was in my late teens, and absolutely, I think validating is the best word, working in that kind of very short fiction format that has a relationship to poetry. More recently, Alex Epstein, who's an Israeli writer who also works in that really short format of a story that might be 2 paragraphs long, or, you know, 70 words long or something like that. And when you find these writers who are working in this very this minority sort of format, it's like going into, you know, the inn in the middle of a blizzard and finding this other person there who has this kind of, you know, this shared interest. And it's wonderful because it's kind of a little bit lonely in that no man's land between poetry and fiction. Other writers, Michael Ondaatje's Coming Through Slaughter, which is a fragmentary novel about a cornet player in New Orleans at the start of the 1900s. And again, it just breaks all the rules. When I read that book, I realized you can do anything. There is no one way that you're supposed to write a short story or a novel. It can take any form that you need it to. It's about really what the story wants. It's about using whatever structure suits the shape of the story that you're telling. So it's this wonderful kind of piecemeal thing that breaks all the rules and was really validating.
And poets?
Leonard Cohen, always. Leonard Cohen is someone. There's a very ratty paperback of his selected works that, which is a book I first read, I think, when I was 13 or 14. I actually recently found some very old watermarked pages of exercise book that I had copied all these poems on because I'd originally borrowed it from the library, and I was so heartbroken about giving back this book that I'd found in a Ferntree Gully library, and I felt so far removed from anything like it that I'd kind of painstakingly copied out all of these poems and put them aside. And I think when I was maybe 15 or 16, I actually found a copy of the book in a secondhand bookstore. But it will come with me to Canada. There are stories that I kind of need to have. There are books that I feel like I need to have close at hand. They're like security blankets.
I did want to ask that. You're in the process of packing up your house and moving your piano and rehousing your cat. What books will make that journey in your 2 suitcases to Canada?
Yeah, well, that's a very good way of looking at it. So Epstein and Phillips and Cohen are certainly in there. Also, as I was talking about before, those stories that help you orient yourself to new surrounds. Alistair MacLeod is a great example of that. He's not quite Newfoundland. He's in Nova Scotia, wonderful Canadian writer who kind of really gets that part of the world, writes really beautifully about that Atlantic Canada region. Australian poets, Sarah Holland-Batt, Aria. Again, that's something that, you know, from the first time I picked it up, it's just been a kind of staple collection that I return to again and again, and often, you know, buy it as a gift for other people and foist it onto other people because I feel like she should just be more widely read. She's one of my favourites.
Searching for a heart of gold.
heart of gold. Lana drove all four of us out to the desert, just so she could toss her shoes up into a tree. It took her three goes. Ha, ha, ha. And by the third try, she was crying hard. "Why'd you do that?" said Mira. "Those shoes are too good for that tree." We looked up into the branches slung with old running shoes and scuffed up boots, and down where some of them lay in the dust beneath the tree, their laces frayed where they'd snapped. Mira was right. Lana's shoes didn't belong there. But she just ran her skinny wrist under her nose and said, "Let's go back now, okay?" She walked shoeless back to the car and got in on the driver's side. On the trip back, we kept stumm, avoiding her sooty eyes in the rearview mirror. We watched her bare feet working the accelerator and clutch. When we stopped for fuel, we watched her stand barefoot on the grease-stained concrete while she filled the tank. Then we watched her dance barefoot down the service station aisles. Heart of Gold was playing over the loudspeakers as she swung slow and sad past the confectionery, past the ice cream freezer. We watched the soles of her feet get blacker and blacker, picking up grime from the tiled floor. We tried our best to make sense of it. These poems are taken from a suite of poems about an island called Barrhaven, which is in Newfoundland, Canada, and which was entirely depopulated in the mid-1960s as part of a government scheme called centralization, where all of the outport communities were moved to the mainland to help diversify and modernize the economy. And this is actually the island where my mother-in-law was moved from when she was a child. And they floated the houses right across the bay and left nothing behind but the cemetery and the church, which was made of brick, and the concrete doorsteps to the houses. Whale Heart. An album of photocopies of photographs of the ancestors. A woman whose face is always scratched out. The interior of the once beautiful church. Young men on the deck of a whaling boat, cutting the tail and fins from a captive humpback, a crude blade attached to a long wooden pole. The whale's still alive while this happens, though weak enough to be lashed to the side of the boat. The boys pose shirtless, triumphant around the immense carcass, their lean arms around each other's shoulders. We try to make out which organ lies at their feet. How big is the heart of a whale? But none of us know. Doorstep. We kick through the waist-high grass on the western side of the island, feeling with our booted feet for the slab of stone that was once the doorstep to your mother's house. Yes, we are very young. We are not sure if the important things have happened to us yet.
Inside my head I cast a shadow, not someone you've seen this side of me. But it drifts across the ground down below, and I can spend my time wondering. times that I am lost on one, and I can turn towards you and ask you what you saw.
And in this Poetica podcast from RN, you've been listening to a conversation with and readings by Josephine Rowe. The sound engineer was Brendan O'Neill, and the program was produced by me, Justine Sloan-Lees. Visit the Poetica webpage for details of Josephine's publications, or to leave us a comment.